So, good morning, everyone. Thanks to the organizers for inviting me. And as you see, I don't have machine learning in the title of my talk. And this is not because I'm not going to talk about machine learning, but because I believe that it's already time to sort of normalize machine learning and just say what we do with machine learning rather than insist on the fact that we do machine learning. So all the work that I'm going to present here, and you're going to see a lot of different examples and a lot of different applications, is largely the work of the PhD students and the postdocs in my group. And I'm going to highlight their names when appropriate. So to give a little bit of motivation, because I mean, I live in a material science department, and I am myself by education something between a theoretical chemist and a condensed matter physicist. And my interest about machine learning for chemistry and materials arises from a deeper interest in the modeling of fluctuations. So if you work in an environment of quantum chemists and a large fraction of solid state physicists, very often people are interested about the configuration of molecules and the materials at the in a local minimum of the potential energy. Because you can do a lot of very interesting physics, you can compute a lot of interesting properties. However, if you look at a simulation that models that system at finite temperature, and here you see a snapshot of hexagonal ice, already at 100 Kelvin, atoms fluctuate a lot about these equilibrium positions. And when you switch on the quantum nature of the nuclei, so you also treat the nuclei as quantum particles, of course, since you have so much hydrogen, the fluctuations are even more pronounced. So keeping in mind that my underlying interest is with modeling fluctuations, let's see what are the problems in incorporating fluctuations in the study of materials and chemical systems. So you have different kinds of physical phenomena for which you would like to incorporate finite temperature and zero point energy fluctuations, but roughly speaking, we could classify them in terms of nuclear quantum effects. So basically, in the kind of world I work with, which is definitely above cryogenic temperatures, we're essentially talking about zero point energy fluctuations, which however are incredibly important, even well above room temperature. And I will give you a few examples of these. And second, very often, people are content with modeling the free energy of a solid using a harmonic approximation, but there are many, many circumstances in which this is not enough, and you need to include the full description of the statistics in anharmonic conditions. And finally, you might be interested in studying phase transitions or activated events, chemical reactions, protein folding, you name it. And in all of these cases, the challenge from a computational point of view is the fact that you don't need to compute the properties of that system once, but typically of the order of a million or a few hundred million times. And this is because, for instance, if you want to model the quantum behavior of nuclei, typically you need to run path integral simulations, and this requires you to model multiple replicas of your system. And if you're not doing quantum Monte Carlo, these replicas don't really contribute to your statistics. So this is on top of any sampling that you have to do, this is another factor of 100 more or less that you have to factor in. If you want to compute thermodynamics for your system, then you are set for running complicated thermodynamic integration paths, and these involve a long simulation time to reduce the statistical error. And if you want to simulate rare events, I mean, if you do nothing, you would just wait forever seeing your molecule fluctuate in one of the metastable states. And even if you play all the tricks of the trade, you are in for millions or billions of energy and forces evaluation. So from the point of view of quantum nuclear effects, which is actually something I worked on for a very long time, I mean, comparatively very long time, essentially since the last years of my PhD, the problem has been reduced considerably because myself, colleagues, and other people in the community have been worked a lot on reducing the cost of path integral simulations. And I recently wrote a review that tries to summarize some of the methods that have been introduced to cut the cost of modeling the quantum nature of the nuclei, ignoring exchange, of course, just nuclei as distinguishable particles. And most of these techniques are based one way or another on the understanding that the at room temperature or even down to a few tens of kelvins, the most pronounced quantum behavior is due to high frequency quasi-harmonic modes that don't really require a full description of an harmonicity. And so either by splitting the potential in two parts or by introducing different kinds of colored noise, Langevin dynamics, or by implementing in an efficient way high order factorization of the quantum Boltzmann operator, you can cut down substantially the cost of incorporating the quantum behavior of the nuclei in your simulations of materials and molecules. So now, once you have cut down, perhaps by a factor of 10 or 20, the cost of running your simulation with quantum nuclei, you can try and go on to model the full quantum mechanical properties of a system. And here, okay, full disclaimer, I know that this room is full of people using quantum Monte Carlo, so I will say that DFT is a pretty decent quantum mechanical treatment of the electrons. But then you still have the quantum mechanical behavior of the nuclei to deal with. And this can be important not only for materials in extreme conditions, either very, very low temperature or very, very high pressure, but also for very mundane problems, such as, for instance, the stability of different phases of paracetamol. Paracetamol can exist in at least two metastable phases. And what we tried to do back in 2016 with Mariana Rossi and Piero Gasparotto was to try and look at the role of fluctuations in the stability of these two different forms. Now, you have seen this figure already in a previous slide. In order to do this, you have to do an incredible amount of sampling over different thermodynamic integration pathways. And I'm not going to tell you how many CO2 tons were produced to run these calculations. But in the end, we could converge all of the different terms. And you know, if you just treat your system classically at the harmonic energy, this contributes 13 millielectron volt per mole to the relative stability of the two forms. And you see that the different terms bring in terms that are of a few millielectron volt per molecule, which you might say, okay, this is not that much, but the point is that actually these small differences are all that it takes to switch the stability between one form and another. And for a pharmaceutical industry, this can mean between a form which is soluble and easily bioavailable to a form that is hard to dissolve and you don't absorb after you eat a tablet. And actually, the point is that the differences, even though they might seem small, they are completely comparable, they are actually much larger than the differences in stability between the different phases that are due to the choice of your density functional. Or, you know, if you go beyond density functional theory, which is something that I very much would like to happen more often, very often the difference between different polymorphs will not be huge. So it could be very well comparable with that few tens of millielectron volt per mole that are due to the thermodynamics and finite temperature sampling. So another example, which I believe is a little bit more relevant also for the topic of quantum computing, is the stability and the behavior of defects in solids. Here I'm actually looking at a very much more materials-y problem, which is that of hydrogen embrittlement. This is a 20 years old, probably more than 20 years old problem, whereby whenever you have steel and you have hydrogen around, and if you have water, you have hydrogen, basically. So hydrogen is everywhere. Hydrogen gets into the material and will make steel brittle. And if you look at the diffusion of a hydrogen atom in the lattice of iron, You see that classically you expect to have an Arrhenius behavior on the diffusion coefficient on the temperature, but quantum mechanically the diffusion coefficient saturates and it starts saturating already at room temperature. So these are effects that are also relevant in the everyday conditions in which you use steel and ferrous materials. And this is also, nuclear quantum effects are also very important in determining the stability of hydrogen bound to a vacancy. So a defect, hydrogen binds to the vacancy, and quantum effects stabilize it by more than 30%. And this is actually quite easy to understand. The hydrogen atom is very much compressed in the lattice of iron. And when it gets into a vacancy, it has more space to breathe. And so when you have quantum delocalization, it will be able to accommodate quantum delocalization much more easily when it sits in a vacancy. Now, both of these examples required an embarrassingly large amount of CPU time to perform. And this is essentially the reason why I started caring about machine learning. So, you know, as a materials modeler, as a computational chemist, you spend at least a third of the time on a project trying to figure out what is an approximation that you can live with in terms of accuracy. And if you care about statistical sampling, this is not just a trade-off between cost and accuracy, but it's a trade-off between accuracy and accuracy. Because if you can only run a few energy and forces evaluation, you will never be able to converge your statistics. So these kind of sampling problems are a particularly favorable scenario for machine learning because when you think about it, you keep fluctuating around the minimum, so you keep encountering configurations that are very similar to configurations that you have already found before. So even if you take a very conservative stance on machine learning, you say, oh, it's just a fancy interpolation machine. Well, fancy interpolation is exactly what you need in order to make sampling of quantum and thermal fluctuations affordable. So when I speak about machine learning, this is my 2 minutes introduction to machine learning, which probably is not necessary with this audience, but what I want to say is that my objective typically is to take configurations of my system, molecules, pieces of graphene, or just atomic environments, and then feed them to whatever regression or classification algorithm you might want to use. And the intermediate step, it's extremely important, and it's the problem of how you take an atomic structure and you represent it so that it becomes the input of some kind of regression machine. So, why is a representation important? Well, imagine, for instance, that you would use something as simple as the Cartesian coordinates of the atoms that compose your molecule. This would be a very well-defined vector in a Hilbert space, but it wouldn't satisfy the most basic symmetries of the problem. If I switch the labeling of 2 atoms, if I rigidly translate or rotate my molecule, the vector of the Cartesian coordinates will change, meaning that my machine learning model will have to learn these invariances. And of course, I could replicate the structures in my training set, but in my opinion, that's a complete waste of time, and what you should do instead is finding a way to incorporate all of these symmetries straight into the representation of your chemical problem. And so we had a paper early this year in which we show how you can build in a very, very abstract fashion, basically using Dirac notation, you can build kets that represent a structure by starting from a very simple non-invariant representation and then starting to build in invariances just by integrating over groups. And what is nice about this is that you end up with abstract objects that you can represent on a real space basis, and then they essentially correspond to n-body correlation functions. But you could also project them on different bases. And what I find particularly pleasing is that a lot of the different representations for machine learning that you might have heard of, you know, SOAP from Gabor Chani and collaborators, Beller Parinello symmetry functions, and many, many others, come out very transparently as being just these objects projected on different bases. So essentially, the relationship between SOAP and Beller-Parinello symmetry functions is the same that you have between Gaussian-type orbitals and Slater orbitals in quantum chemistry. Just two different choices of bases that might be more or less convenient depending on your application. And thinking in this very, very abstract manner is also very useful when you work with materials that contain many, many different compounds. Because when you think about it, if you want to learn the properties of materials across the periodic table, you add to the problem of configurational complexity of your system also that of chemical complexity. So you have, I don't know, 40 elements that could enter your material. You need to learn the behavior of elements in a 40-dimensional space. So the idea that we had was metaphorically, to go back to classical elements and say, okay, how about we represent actual elements in a reduced dimensional chemical space so that the machine learning problem becomes the machine learning problem of learning the behavior of fire, earth, and water, and simultaneously the composition of actual elements into this reduced dimensionality basis of classical elements. And if you do this, not only you improve the efficiency of a machine learning model that tries to learn across the periodic table, but what is kind of cute is that you also find that if you reduce the dimensionality of chemical space to 2D, you end up with the elements being represented by 2D vectors. And what is very pleasing is that just from the exercise of optimizing the performance of the regression model, you end up with elements clustered in a way that is very, very much reminiscent of the periodic table. And I mean, this typically chemists like very much. Now, let me give you a few examples of applications you can do with all of this framework. So here I just want to give you an idea of how generally applicable this is. So first example I want to show you is this is a typical benchmark system. This is a set of 130,000 small organic molecules that were proposed by Anatole von Lilienfeld and collaborators as a benchmark system for these kind of machine learning applications. And here we are basically trying to machine learn the atomization energy of all of these molecules. And here you can see learning curves. Honestly, I mean, my attitude is that I tend not to believe a machine learning paper that doesn't include learning curves, because learning curves tell you how well your model improve its accuracy as you increase the size of the training set. So you would like to always see learning curves that go down, and of course that are as low as possible. And what you can sort of glance here is that we have done different regression exercises using a representation of our molecule that is restricted to cutoff radii of different size. And what is very interesting is that if you choose a very short range cutoff, only 2 angstrom, you will have a learning curve that starts off very, very low, but then saturates. And this is because initially you are reducing the complexity of your problem, and in the end, most of covalent bonding is well defined by the bonding pattern, which is well represented within 2 angstrom. Then if you want to increase your train set size, then you have to go to a larger cutoff, let's say 3 angstrom, and eventually also this curve would saturate. So the idea is that bonding is a multi-scale phenomenon. It's something that involves interactions on different scales. And indeed, if we build a representation that weights information from different length scales appropriately, we get a model that performs much better than any of the models which is focused on a specific length scale. You can also apply these to condensed phases. So this is the very same framework, of course, new training data, and here we are trying to learn the relative stabilities of different phases of a molecular crystal. So like with paracetamol, but now these molecules have an even richer landscape of possible polymorphs, and we are trying, using a small number of training structures, to learn the relative stability of all the different polymorphs. And what you can see here is that, okay, this works super well. I mean, we have an error which is below a kilojoule per mole. But you can also learn the fact that machine learning really is a little bit a fancy interpolation machine. And it's not magic. So if you have a molecule that has a more complicated potential energy landscape, such as this one, which has an asymmetric substitution pattern, which leads to some sort of glassy configuration landscape, machine learning has a much harder time learn than in the case of simpler molecules that can pack with a, the number of polymorphs is actually pretty much the same, but the complexity in terms of the intrinsic variability of the packing is much, much harder for 5B than for pentasine. You can also learn other properties other than just the binding energy. For instance, you can learn NMR chemical shieldings, which is something which is very important, again, for molecular materials to determine the structure. And it's interesting because you can work with small quantity of powdered compounds. And the difficulty is that you need to compare your experimentally determined shieldings with some shieldings obtained by simulations over a set of different candidate compounds. And essentially what you can see here is that both DFT and a machine learning model trained on DFT can identify what is the right structure by in comparison with experiment. And we also have if you go to shiftml.org, you can basically upload a structure made up of carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, and oxygen, and it will generate the chemical shieldings for you. You can also use these to predict the affinity of molecules to proteins. And here, I mean, full disclosure, I'm not a biochemist. I have no idea what I'm talking about. I just downloaded a dataset, the Dude, and this dataset contains a couple of dozen proteins. And for each protein, you have 200 molecules that are known to bind and 200 that are known not to bind. And here, the idea is to build a classifier that, using, again, a small number of training structures, tells us for all the other structures, will they bind or not bind? And there are, I have a tendency of packing the slides with too much information, but okay, the short message is that if we play all the tricks with less than 40 training structures, we can get a 98% classification accuracy. But the most interesting thing, in my opinion, is that, so these curves qualify how good is the classifier. So the best classifier would have a curve that follows this edge of the square, and a classifier which is as good as tossing a coin would follow the diagonal. Now, there is one protein for which we are barely better than tossing a coin, which was kind of disappointing. And then, even without knowing anything about biochemistry, we went and looked a little bit into this, and we found out that there was a clerical error in the database. So for this protein, the same molecule was listed both as binding and as not binding. So this kind of contradictory data would contradict, would confuse the hell out of the classifier, and as a result, you get this very, very poor performance. So we rolled back to a previous version of the database that didn't include this clerical error, and the protein went back in line with all the others. Another example, as I said before, I mean, I use DFT, but I'm not particularly a fan of DFT, and there are many properties for which DFT is pretty bad. Polarizability is one of these, and so I teamed up with Rob Di Stasio from Cornell, who, contrary to me, is a proper quantum chemist and knows how to run linear response coupled clusters to compute accurate polarizabilities of molecules, and then we built a machine learning model out of these. And there is a little detail that I don't have the time to discuss, but polarizability is tricky because polarizability is a tensor. So the invariance properties that you would need to enforce to learn a scalar become more complicated here. Here you have to build a machine learning model and a representation that is covariant with rotations. So having done that, we could build a machine learning model for the polarizability. And again, we will get all of the starml.org domains eventually, so you can go on alphaml.org and upload the molecule and see for yourself. And what is interesting is that linear response coupled cluster theory is really complicated and expensive. So we train the model on small organic molecules up to 7 heavy atoms. And then Rob and his students went on to compute a few showcase molecules. The biggest one is acyclovir, which has 15 heavy atoms and took 1 month to run on a node with 1.5 terabytes of RAM. But then even with these molecules, you can find that the machine learning model that you can run in a fraction of a second is actually more accurate than DFT, even when making predictions on these molecules that are much larger and different from those that we have trained the model on. And final example, again, exploiting the fact that we have a machine learning framework that can learn tensorial properties, now we can also learn the three-dimensional charge density. And by learning the charge density, and the model is very transferable. So here we are learning the charge density on a data set of small dimers of organic molecules. And then we can predict the charge density on small polypeptides. And the size of the polypeptides is basically constrained not by the machine learning prediction, but by the need of running a reference calculation to check how good is the model. And I mean, this is accurate enough to compute all sort of charge density topology analysis that quantum chemistry people love. And for instance, if you get a cyclopeptide, again, this is not magic. So if you get a configuration that is particularly bizarre, such as this one in which you have very strained bonds, the accuracy of the model will degrade. But still, this is accurate enough to do a lot of things with it. So let me now give you 2 examples, very briefly, of the applications of all of these to actual complicated problems. So the first problem I want to talk about is the thermodynamics of water, both the liquid and the different solid phases of water. So I don't know if you know about this, but there are 2 phases of ice, 1 hexagonal and 1 cubic. It's very, so as everyone knows, snowflakes are hexagonal. So we know that the hexagonal phase is the one which is stable at ambient conditions. But it's very high. Experimentally, you can obtain ice which is not 100% cubic, but is stuck in disorder. And the indications are that actually the relative stability of the 2 phases are almost identical in stability. So it's very, very hard to determine the relative stability of these 2 phases computationally. So here, what we did was set up a scheme in which we do all of the thermodynamic integrations and the complicated sampling at the level of a machine learning potential. And then, since that here we are looking after energy differences of the order of 0. Something millielectron volt per molecule, at the end we promote the results to the full ab initio. In this case, this is a specific flavor of a hybrid DFT that is apparently particularly good for water. And at the end, we need to do this final step of promoting the energetics at the DFT level, because the machine learning model is just not accurate enough to differentiate these tiny energy differences. But once you do this, you get fantastic agreement on the pair correlation function, which is actually not a great, it's very easy to get the good correlation function for the wrong reasons, but you also get a lot of other properties better than most DFT would give you, so density, difference between classical and quantum temperature density curve. You can get, you do the integration from classical to quantum, so you can also get the difference in chemical potential between hexagonal ice and water, so 0 here would be the melting point. And you see there is a considerable difference between the curve with the neural network in blue and the classical curve in red promoted to the DFT level. So you, and actually, interestingly, I mean, since we are still using DFT, so our reference is not exact, classical water has a perfect melting point. When you switch on quantum effects, we overpredict, overcorrect a little bit, and we go down to a melting point around 270 Kelvin, which is fantastic anyway. And another interesting observation is that people in the ab initio community for a lot of time have run DCHUO as a way of getting away with not including quantum effects. And interestingly, it turns out that there is a cancellation along the thermodynamic integral, so classical DFT and DCHUO actually are almost identical. So there was an intuition in the early days where people were running DCHUO classically. It actually comes very, very close to fully quantized DCHUO. And then eventually you can try and answer this question about the relative stability of hexagonal and cubic ice, and look at the scale. I mean, here we are talking about 0.2 milliliter volt per molecule. So to be completely honest with you, the error bars are comparable to the energy difference between the two. But there are signs that the quantum fluctuations are important in pushing hexagonal ice above cubic ice close to the melting point. Now, I want to give as a final example some work that we have been doing recently on the phase diagram of hydrogen at high pressure. So this is a very, very complicated problem. High pressure hydrogen has a very complicated phase diagram with a gazillion of competing solid phases. And in the liquid phase, there is a transition between a atomic phase that has a metallic behavior and the molecular phase that instead is an insulator. So the problem is that as any complicated potentially two-phase system, the statistical mechanics of this system is tricky. It's not far from trivial. And so we thought that it would have been a good idea to train a machine learning model so that we could run fully converged statistical sampling. And you can train a machine learning model with a little bit less accuracy than what I would have liked, but this is where we are at now. So over most of the temperature pressure region, we are below 10 milliliter volt per atom. But there are some regions at very high temperature. In a certain sense, when you go to very, very high temperature, you can also tolerate a little bit of a larger error. And if you build, if you use this, now running these simulations become essentially free compared to running a DFT. And so you can very extensively, with large simulation boxes, map the entirety of the phase diagram, and you can find the melting curve, you can find a very, very rich polymorphism in the solid phase, and here we are doing direct quenches, so we really just observe whatever we get. And interestingly, we find no trace of a sharp liquid-liquid phase transition in the liquid region. And instead, we find that you can fit beautifully a regular solution model to the two-phase region. So essentially, you can describe the liquid as a mixture of atomic and molecular hydrogen. And then you build a very simple regular solution model out of this. And then regular solution models can have mixing, or can be perfectly mixed, or can demix. And in this way, you can determine the coexistence line and where the critical point is. And if you do that, you find perfect match between the regular solution model and the outcome of simulations, and you find a critical point that is at much, much higher pressure. No, normally, it is believed that the critical point sits around here, but we find a critical point sitting at a much, much higher pressure and lower temperature. Now, of course, there is a lot of DFT-based and also some QMC-based evidence that there is a liquid-liquid phase transition. So we couldn't ignore the possibility that the machine learning potential was not good enough. So we went back to the region where there is a clear discontinuity in the pressure density curve, and we just ran ab initio simulations there. And what we found is that indeed we find a discontinuity. But then you look a little bit more closely and you find that actually there is pretty good agreement between the machine learning potential and the DFT in this region. And the interesting observation is that both observe a sharp drop of the diffusion coefficient when you cross this phase line. And now, of course, this will need to be triple checked and analyzed in very much more detail. And in particular, I mean, the obvious extension of all of these is to use something better than DFT as the reference energetics. But what is interesting is that around 1,000 Kelvin, where people have observed, and we also have observed this sharp transition, you actually find that the system goes solid. And you find a lot of, depending on the pressure, you find different solid phases. But essentially, every time we observe a discontinuity, even up to 1200 Kelvin, we do observe solid-like structures. So what we suspect is that given the complex thermodynamic behavior of this system, there are very strong finite size effects. And we observe, for instance, a noticeable difference between simulations performed at constant volume and constant pressure. And in general, our impression is that there is a transition to a defective solid phase that doesn't look like a solid and that still has some residual diffusivity due to the finite size of the system. But as you go to larger systems, as you can afford using a neural network potential, you find that the diffusivity goes down to zero and you get a bona fide solid. Of course, this will be a little bit controversial and we will have to see if this stands up to scrutiny. So to summarize, I think that what I find most interesting about the bronze and the gold age of machine learning for chemistry and material science is the fact that this comes about at the same time where people started to realize the importance of including finite temperature thermodynamics and nuclear quantum fluctuations. And I believe that by combining all the work that has been done over the past few years in making sampling of thermal and quantum fluctuations more efficient with the use of machine learning potential to bring accuracy of electronic structure methods down to a level where you can do extensive sampling without having to compromise on the system size and the extensiveness of sampling, we'll really be able to get into regions where we have not been able to go this far. And I really think that so the combination of sampling and machine learning will make it possible to nail down the problem of finite temperature thermodynamics of complex systems and materials. So thank you for your attention. And if you have questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thanks very much. That was a very interesting talk. I have a question about your what you just presented about the hydrogen.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, the liquid-liquid transition, it also corresponds to a metal, or sorry, an insulator-metal transition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mean that?
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
And so I've been kind of worried about using these sort of machine learning models that are sort of assume that everything is continuous as a function of things like basically have a discontinuous transition in the electronic structure at that point. So mm-hmm. my question is, why should I trust your model as I go through a discontinuous transition in the electronic structure?
Absolutely. So, well, first of all that we're doing is Born-Oppenheimer. So the electronic transition is slaved by the transition of the nuclear degrees of freedom, at least within what we're doing. What pretty much everybody is doing in here. But absolutely. So, I mean, the moment where we saw a discrepancy with the established electronic structure calculations, we went back and ran the electronic structure calculations because with this level of accuracy, for sure, you cannot trust 100% your machine learning model. So in the end, I think that this is where there is still work to be done. But my point is that in general, there is a, you know, being able to test your ideas quickly using a machine learning potential and then just correcting with free energy perturbation to go to the full ab initio result, or you know, running a smaller calculation with ab initio but being able to extrapolate the behavior to larger system size with the help of machine learning. Something that we do a lot is do multiple time step integration. So we run the neural network or the machine learning potential, and then every 10 steps, let's say, we apply a correction to go fully ab initio. This cuts down by a factor of 10 the cost of your ab initio calculation. So there are many things that you can do pragmatically to already do a lot more by using machine learning. But I agree 100% with you that for the kind of non-local physics that is into play here, having a machine learning model that also can deal with non-locality would be extremely important.
Sure. Okay, thank you very much for your talk. And I have a very general question about, you talk about symmetries, mm-hmm. and can you give some maybe heuristic recipe or method how to create effective machine learning network which can use this symmetry? How can I apply this knowledge of symmetry and create efficient machine learning?
Okay, yes, thanks for the question. So basically, we have this general idea. This actually was pioneered a couple of years ago by Sandro De Vita and his student Aldo Glielmo, where they started doing this HAAR integration for kernel learning. So in this paper, we show how you can do the same thing working at the level of the representation. So basically, you can write your representation as a vector. So what I should say is that no matter what you do, whether you're using you're choosing to represent your structures in terms of feature vectors, distances, or kernels, it really doesn't matter, right? In the end, you can always convert one into the other. So what we chose to do was to associate an abstract ket to a structure, and then just start doing integration over the group. So if you, and this is really nice because, for instance, something that we are also doing, you can also integrate over discrete groups if you wanted. If you have a system that has discrete point group symmetries, you can sum over the symmetries. And you get, representations that fulfill automatically the symmetries. Now, an interesting point is that, if you do this naively, the integration might lead you to loss of descriptive power. So for instance, if you take, I didn't have the time to do the full construction, but if you start from this object, which is translationally symmetric, and you integrate over the rotation group, you end up with something that only contains information about pair correlations. However, what you can do is that you take a tensor product of your ket, you integrate over the rotation group. Now it's something that depends on the position of two particles. It has a huge null space, and effectively, it's a three-body correlation function. So this combination of tensor products and integration over continuous or discrete symmetric groups, in my opinion, is a very, very general strategy to construct symmetrized representations.
Thank you. Okay, one more quick question while Maria sets up.
In this hydrogen, you have shown that
so it's
this
it's,
means it's a bias.
So it's like. So it's complicated at the very, you know, like in the relationship status on Facebook, it's complicated. There is certainly, if you observe one of these simulations, you observe that it keeps having transitions, okay? So the finite system size favors transitions because you lower the barrier to nucleate a different phase. So what we observe is that the system keeps going back and forth between a solid and a defective solid In my impression, yes, and even at 1200 Kelvin, you observe configurations that are clearly solid. Well, I mean, you have a transition. There is no question that you have a transition. The question is, I think that, of course, you need the melting line will not be the same in simulations and in experiment. So you need to stay within a paradigm. So staying within the paradigm of DFT simulations of these, the question is, what is happening there? What happens in experiments is harder to tell, but something that I find very interesting is that different experiments lead to different results. And if you this is what you would expect if you are supercritical and you are looking at Widom lines. So you have different properties that you are looking at. You will have an anomalous behavior at different points. So this is the same thing that happens, for instance, with the infamous liquid-liquid phase transition in water. You get diverging Widom lines that emanate from a critical point that can be hidden inside the solid phase. But it's a difficult problem, and I think that we will have to look at it again. I don't think that the story is over.
Great, thank you, Kelly.